Does anyone have any comments or thoughts or questions or anything from this? Yes, Sarah. Go ahead.
Little question. When Swami talks about spiritual doubt, I'm not exactly sure what that means and what it refers to. Maybe could you elucidate that?
Because he talks about having been eaten up with doubts in the past.
Yeah.
The question is, when Swami talks about spiritual doubts, what does he mean?
Yeah.
He made an interesting comment also, which he said, I think it was in this book, he said that he had overcome spiritual doubt almost completely, and it only arose sometimes now as self-doubt, which is just an interesting sort of... Sometimes when Swamiji writes, after he finished writing The Path, I felt like, and it's true of a lot of his books, is that he describes the tops of mountains. It's sort of like he skips across the top of a mountain range, and in the conclusions that he draws from that vantage point, there's the whole path up to that, that he's now just summarized in one sentence, and that you have to stop and think and realize how many levels of meaning there are before he gets to that simple point. And sometimes, it's one of the reasons I love to do these books, is because it forces me to go sentence by sentence in these. Otherwise, you just read through and it all makes sense. And you don't necessarily stop and see what each of those sentences is. Sometimes in reflecting on books that he's written, I'll have just remembered some wonderfully profound thought and I'll go back to find it. And it's like one sentence. And in my mind, it's elevated, you know, to like a whole essay on its own. And I'll realize it's just one or two sentences. He just covered it. But once you tune in, or when you tune in, sometimes the implications make it seem like it was a huge statement. But it is. It's remarkable writing, just from that point of view. The question is spiritual doubt. Well, you know, it's a lot of just what I've been talking about when I've been talking about the contrast between America and India. You know, in America, people don't just automatically have a lot of faith. Sort of our mindset, we just walk around and maybe these teachings are true and I'll give it a try, but I'm not really sure if it's true. There's no sort of assumption that God is part of our lives, that God is loving, that God can be realized. There's just always this underlying sort of doubt about it. Maybe Ananda is true, but then on the other hand, who knows? And when Swami talks about being eaten up with that, I mean, how many people do you know, Sarah? You've been here a long, long time. Think how many people have come and gone. Now, one of the things that often causes people to leave is that somehow doubt enters their mind. I've had the direct experience with so many people who are, they start out so fresh and enthusiastic, and they're just so eager to do it, and then after a while they begin to wonder, you know, does this really work? I've been meditating now for a year and I haven't had the experiences that I thought I would have. I got Kriya, it didn't really mean that much to me. Look at that person, they died of cancer. Why would they die of cancer if they were part of Ananda? You know, look at this, what's happened in Assisi. These people have been, you know, persecuted by the police. Why would they be persecuted by the police if God was really protecting them? And just all these ideas that you have that about how conditions are supposed to be, and then when those conditions aren't met, then you question your basic assumption. Does this teaching even work? Is this really even good for me? And doubt, as Master said, is just a private hell, because it's very hard to go forward. You do kriyas for a couple of days, and then you begin to wonder if it's doing you any good, so you don't do it for a week. And then you do it again for 2 days, and then you wonder whether it's doing any good, and then you wonder whether maybe this path isn't as good as another path, so you go and try that one for a year, and gee, that one doesn't work so good, and then you come back here, but then everything's changed here. I mean, you can see how it just goes on and on and on. And when Swamiji writes, by contrast, I mean, Swamiji's life is so... this whole thing with that he describes here with... the explanation given by that man who showed up at Ananda to talk about in past lives Swami was actually disloyal to Master and that Tara is still living from all of that. And then Swami uses the phrase, well, I'm loyal to my core now. And what you see all through this is, even going back before this book starts, Swamiji was such an intense seeker, as he describes in The Path, you know, that he sort of worked his way through all these life experiences before he was 22 and worked his way just on his own without any input from any outside source to an intuitive understanding of the presence of God in people's lives, the purpose of life being to find God, and was ready to leave everything behind to go and follow that. And this, of course, is in the 1940s. This is not the 60s or 70s or 80s or 90s when this is common. This is when nobody was doing this. And he was willing to just leave absolutely everything in his planning. And then at that point, Master came. Now, his mind was honed to such a fine point then, and his emotions and his commitment were honed to such a fine point, and his karma from past lives, that all he had to do was see that picture of Master. No, that's not true, because he had to see it twice. First time he saw it, he turned away from it. But the second time, when he was drawn back to it, and he describes how he picked up the book, and then he met that old friend in the bookstore who starts talking to him about how he's going to make a killing in the advertising field or whatever it was. And Swamiji uses such a touching phrase. He said, "The world and I were strangers, but this Indian yogi and I, he was my own." Now, that kind of faith which Swamiji had from that moment, without a moment's wavering until now, is the result of a lot of tapasya and a lot of working through every kind of doubt that can come. Now, but you know, he did. Last week I talked about how in the face of the behavior of his guru bhais in SRF, in their attack of Ananda, how Swami did have that time when he thought, why? Does this path really work? If such long-time disciples could do such a thing, that's a form of doubt. Now he spent a day and a night and came up with an answer. But that's doubt, that's spiritual doubt. And people do. I mean, repeatedly they ask that very question. Well, if in fact those direct disciples are behaving as inappropriately as they appear to be, what does that say about the path? That's spiritual doubt. And then he has that statement about how then it comes out as self-doubt. So you can have the thought that, well, the spiritual path works, but it doesn't work for me. I mean, it works for everyone, but not for me. It's like Swamiji, you know, went through a period of just wondering whether Master really cared about him. And somebody tried to help him by telling him that Master cared about her. And Swami said, well, it wasn't that he didn't think Master was capable of love. The doubt was whether Master loved him. And that would be self-doubt that you would have. You would trust the path, but you wouldn't necessarily trust it as far as you yourself were concerned. And that, of course, also can drive you to distraction. Yeah. Does that make sense? And Swamiji, that's what he also... I love the way he talks about that. He said, because he had so many incarnations of working through every doubt there was to have, that's one of the things that makes him a good teacher, is because he can just anticipate what people are going to be concerned about and where the flaws and the logic are going to be for them. And then just when he talks or when he writes, he can cover all those bases, things that other people might not even think about, but because he remembers on some level living through it. And so he tries to take you through whatever it was that got him out of that particular self-created cul-de-sac. And it's also the karma of why he has to teach a lot, because the karma of having doubted himself and probably having sown doubt in the minds of others by his very vibration, if not by his wrong words, he has to right all that karma by putting out this tremendous effort now to draw people to spiritual truth. So it is an interesting question. It's also important because we all have it. Any other questions? Yes, Brenda.
I first have to say that this book has just really been great for me. Mm-hmm. Because he tells story after story, and I can just get involved in the story. And then he can give me some wisdom on the side. And then
yeah. I'm open to it. That's the easiest way, yeah.
Uh-huh.
No. that was when Swamiji suggested that they send tape recordings of their sermons out to the centers, and they could be played at the centers. And the board of directors objected that they couldn't possibly send them out to the centers because they would have to review every sermon before they would send them out. And Swami said, well, if they're good enough to deliver in the churches, well, they're certainly good enough to be sent out to the centers. But just to comply, he recorded one of his sermons and he gave it to the board to review, and Rinalini came back and said, you said the soul evolves. Master said the soul doesn't evolve. Well, that means that the soul is eternal and is manifested from the spirit, and therefore how could it evolve? The soul is always one with the infinite. How can there be evolution? Except Swami answered by saying, Master himself spoke of the soul evolving. Even though it might not be technically correct, as a manner of speaking, it's a way of saying that the individual consciousness comes to a greater and greater state of realization. I didn't finish it, I just mentioned it. But it was more of an example of how aggravating Swami's life was.
So was that nitpicking that they were doing around?
Yes, it was the nitpicking. And it was also the absolute necessity to control everything, but it's such a good example, because it just shows you how alien their mindsets were one to another. And the last week I spent a lot of time, even or maybe the week before, trying to explain which I was explaining to myself, because I never really could even understand what the threat was. But now I do understand what it was that they were afraid of. They're afraid that these teachings will get in the hand of somebody who will then just start messing them up. And then pretty soon no one will even remember what the true teaching is. So it's better that it never get into those people's hands, but that it always be strictly controlled by somebody who absolutely knows what it is. And they weren't always reasonable in that, such as this example. I mean, if it was good enough for the churches, it was probably good enough for the centers, but if you could deliver the message to 150 people, it could probably be tape recorded for 3 or 5. But it's a question of control and the fear of letting things get out of hand, which they can quite quickly. You know, you either have to go as they have gone, or you have to go as we have gone, which is just, you have to be very free. It's hard to find a middle. You have to just accept that it's going to happen, and you keep it strong by inspiration, and you don't worry about it. In many ways, Swamiji, he used to say this more often, the fact that SRF has been so tight with it has given us a lot of freedom, because they're so busy being tight with it, nobody else needs to do that. But any other questions or thoughts? Okay. Well, let's see. Now, this whole chapter, this first chapter, I returned to America. I love to just sort of walk through this story as Swami himself lives it. You know, this is the story where he talks about, his own personal shortcomings and all of that means. But also, you have this picture again. He's one of the factors that comes out later when Taramata calls him and tells him that they don't want that property. And he just instantly answers, all right, if you don't want it, that's fine. You have to really see Swamiji in his role as a monk, and as a monk under obedience. That comes out a little later in another part of this book, when he talks a lot about individuals in religious institutions. It's an important part of it, because with so much emphasis on the abuses that are inherent in religious institutions, and such a strong importance that Swami gives to individual inspiration, one doesn't want to go too far, because it's very tricky. I had an interesting experience just a couple of days ago. Someone was interviewing me for a PhD thesis. They're doing a bunch of interviews, and I was one of them. They asked to talk, and it's just one of those questionnaire kind of things. And it was all about, I'm not sure what, intuition, wisdom, personal development. And there was a whole series of questions that were supposed to determine whether or not you were a logical or an intuitive type. Now, in fact, I probably am right in the middle. I would probably say I'm probably half of one and half of another. But the questions were phrased in such a way that you had to be either one or the other. And the questions were phrased in such a way as to ask the question essentially, is your intuition infallible? Do you always go by your intuition? And of course, when asked such a question, I always said no. Are your hunches always right? Can you read people? Can you do this? And I said in every single case, no, because it was such an unqualified yes or no answer. And it seems to me that anybody who has even a little bit of real intuition is intuitive enough to realize that you're often wrong. And so you just can't answer a question like that yes or no. So she was sort of surprised that I came out such a unqualified, logical type, when you would have anticipated that I would come out intuitive. Now, part of that has been, and it's no paradox, the training that we've received at Ananda. And it stems from here. There is a profound and important role in being a disciple also, and even being a monastic. And obedience, even as we call it cooperative obedience, is a really big part of the path. Because one of the things that the path of self-realization gives us is the benefit of other people's experience. And even though we do have the freedom to follow our own inspiration to a very large extent, it's also extremely important for us to recognize that we should listen when people who've had more experience than we have make suggestions. We don't have to listen mindlessly. We shouldn't listen mindlessly or blindly, but we should listen. And so Swamiji's going back to America and back to Dhyamata, and we have to, again, appreciate, you know, the degree to which he saw her and Taramata too as senior disciples, and the degree to which, even if he had his own doubts or questions about various things that they were doing, doubts or questions with which grew more over time, much later, many years later, but fundamentally he saw himself under obedience to them. First to the guru, but secondarily to his monastic superiors. And it's an important thing to appreciate that part of Swami's power is the fact that he was also willing to be a disciple and to be a devotee and just to be a monk in those circumstances. He didn't declare his independence from that prematurely or casually. And each of us should just think about, you know, the strength of that. It's a razor's edge, I admit it. But we shouldn't be too sure of ourselves. And through the years with Ananda, we all certainly found that it's beneficial to check in and find out. So now you also have to realize, just again to sort of get the picture, Dhyamata goes over to India after Master has passed away. Was it 1958 that she goes? And they discover that there's just nothing happening in India. I mean, there's worse than nothing happening. You know, there's intrigue, and just as we talked about last week, the effort to get them thrown out of the country, and a lot of blame. And there was also Dhyamata actually dismissed someone who was high up in YSS. He doesn't write about that in detail. But there was some real question of wrongdoing and so on like this. And Swami nowadays is not quite sure what the truth of the whole situation was, because everybody was intriguing against everyone else. But there they went back to Master's homeland, and there was just nothing happening. And it was a source of great heartache to all of them. And Swamiji has this consciousness of being responsible. I had an interesting conversation recently with someone, and we were talking about... The example I used... was the experiences that I've had with David over the years. You know, I can be apparently spiritual and very optimistic about certain situations and just be, oh, I know it'll work out. And David sometimes will have a more intense and serious energy about it because he's the one who's going to have to make it work out, right? And I know I've made that mistake with Swami at different times too, just in a very sort of what seems like pseudo-spiritual way, just being so positive when he seems more intent, because mine is just an empty words, but he knows that the tapasya to make it successful is going to come out of him, and so he's taking it a lot more seriously than I am in my sort of frivolous. And that's what, in the last chapter, when Swamiji, when they were leaving India, and Sister Revati and were there, and they were talking about what's going to become of Master's work. And Revati said, Master is here, he'll take care of it. And Swami answered, well, Master's been here for 40 years and he hasn't done anything. Now that's the kind of comment that a person would make who actually intends to do something. So Swami's there in India and he has the thought in his mind that Master wants him to do something in India. That's a very important key to all of this. Swamiji was always under the impression that Master wanted him to go to India and help with his work there. Now, for Swamiji, that's no small commission, especially when you take into account you have a great work to do. Every man has disappointed me, but not, you know, you mustn't disappoint me. And Swami sees this as something that Master has put on his list of things he's supposed to do. So Swamiji has all these And so he's been in India and he's been so frustrated because Dhyanamata has put Binay in charge and Binay doesn't really seem to have any understanding as far as Swami can see. And even more than that, as we were talking last week, Swami finally got his chance. He went out and he did those lectures and all these people came and he could just see, you know, this could really happen. And he's, what, in his mid-30s? And this is really his first chance. He's been a disciple all this time, 12 years probably about that, at that point. And he just really sees that the doors are open. So he comes back to America and he, you know, tells Dhyanamata about these plans. And it's also very important in the course of the story because Dhyanamata, as you find out later, made it seem as if he acted completely on his own. So you have, at this part of the story, you have several things that are important. You have Swamiji's, from the point of view of Swami really trying to explain what happened with SRF, you have him trying to set the record straight on his communication with Dhyanamata, which is simply, SRF has tried to have other thoughts be true, that he acted without authorization and so on. But he didn't. He was in communication with her. But then the rest of this whole chapter is all about, you know, the involvement he got into with this woman in SRF. And Swamiji also just talking. And, you know, it's so interesting because it's a very delicate subject to talk about sexual temptation, falling into that trap. How does a person feel about that? How do you deal with that? And right now, at this moment, you know, in Ananda's history, it's not a big story, but of course this was such a huge thing that happened from 1994 to, you know, until 1998 when that sexual harassment lawsuit was filed and women accused Swamiji of sexual activity when he was supposed to be celibate. And it was huge, terrible brouhaha got started that just got so insanely out of proportion. And it isn't happening right now. But it is a quality of America to become very obsessive about these things. And it's an important aspect of life to understand because it plays such a big role in everybody's life. And whether you're trying to be celibate or just trying to be faithful to whatever vows you may have taken, marriage vows or whatever vows you may have taken or whatever life you've put in front of you, Swamiji talks here about something that is really a very serious reality and talks a little bit about how Master dealt with him about it and how he's worked with himself. And it's important things to understand. It's also important to understand because people have such an unrealistic expectation about what it means to take a vow of celibacy. As Swami himself says, when I took that vow, it wasn't a declaration that this was who I was. It was a declaration merely that this is who I would try to become. And then he also just tells us this sort of small point that just slides in here, which is that Master told him not to speak to anyone about it. Not anyone. Not Rajasi, Dr. Lewis, not anyone. This came out in a most interesting manner, in a very dramatic scene that took place in the middle of the Bertolucci lawsuit when various women had accused Swamiji. You know, the facts of just to set the record straight. In 1981, Swamiji publicly announced that he was no longer going to be a celibate monk. And from 1981 until 1995, he wasn't living that lifestyle. He was still called Swami because the word means teacher. But it was clear to everyone he was married. He had open relationships. And during the time that he was accused of having relationships with women was a time when he had declared he wasn't going to be a celibate anymore. I sort of said to people later, what do you think that meant? You know, like, think about it. What do you think it meant? But in any case, when the accusations were leveled at Swamiji, Swami was absolutely silent about it. He just refused to say anything. And people were demanding explanations and revelations. He had many reasons for not answering, one of which was, quite simply, I don't owe you an explanation. You know, I've never asked you to justify your life to me, and I don't see any reason why I have to justify my life to you. I've never asked anything of you. And you, when you stopped and thought about it, you realized you never had. He said, I've just lived my life and been helpful as I could. And he never had. He never By contrast, I want to say a few things about that. Like, there was another ashram that a lot of ashrams were coming to pieces over sexual revelations at that period of time. The Swami said Satan was trying to mow down the yoga movement. In fact, Swami himself said that he prayed to Divine Mother. He said, somebody has to stand up to it. He said, I will stand up to it. And he did. He really took the heat. And it was interesting because in our ashram, it was not an internal dispute. In some of the other ashrams, they broke apart from the inside. But ours was an external attack because we were strong in our loyalty to Swami. But Swamiji, when these revelations came out, when these women made accusations to him, which were very, I mean, they were presented extremely luridly, but the actual facts, when Swami later testified, were so minor, and they were not abusive. You know, it was the story, as Swamiji said, of a man who wasn't always perfect. You know, but it wasn't an abuse of position or power as it was presented, which is completely different. But Swami never said a word. He just wouldn't say anything in his defense. He wouldn't speak about it. He just wouldn't relate to it. And finally, Flynn, the attorney for Bertolucci, got Swamiji into depositions and got him backed into a corner and demanded that he answer direct questions. And Swami refused to answer. And there was a judge sitting in on the depositions as a referee because Flynn had been so abusive we had to have a judge there. And it was like there was the question of whether the judge was going to declare Swamiji in contempt because he was refusing to answer these questions. And our lawyer called a recess. And we went out to a restaurant nearby. And Swami says, he told us, he said, Master told me never to speak about this. He said, it's been very difficult for me. It's not my nature to be secretive. He said, I've always been too open, just like he writes here. He said, but Master told me never to speak of it. He said, so? He said, if it were just me alone, he said, I wouldn't speak of it now. He said, but if I hold to what Master said, it will hurt Ananda. He said, so I feel on the horns of a dilemma. And then he turned to Sheila, myself, Jyotish, Dr. Peter, John Parsons. He said, what should I do? Like that. Later on, Swamiji said he already knew what he was going to do. He wasn't really giving the decision over to us, but he was testing the decision. And then Swami just went silent again. He just sat there. You know, we sort of all just like looked at each other like, well, what should you do? But our consensus was the same as his, which is that whatever purpose Master had in mind had been served, and it didn't. The only reason to steadfastly obey such a thing and go to prison for it is to prove something to yourself, really. And at that point, it didn't seem necessary. And that was the conclusion Swamiji had come to. So he went back in and he answered, you know, simple questions. And you can read it all on the internet. So the questions are very simple and the answers were very simple. And that was the story. But it was when Swami then afterwards wrote this, and now that he felt that he could speak about these things, because he somehow felt inwardly that whatever Master's prohibition to him. But isn't it just interesting how everything gets set up that way? Because but what it also has done is it's created with Swami as an example a real challenge to a lot of really immature attitudes that people carry. Swamiji, in the midst of the Bertolucci lawsuit, wrote a paper called Guru's Celibacy and Spiritual Authority. And it was a very, very good paper. And he just basically wrote, you know, who are you to judge these people? And who are you to decide that this is the criteria of whether or not someone has anything to teach you? And how can you be so arrogant as to think that you can't learn, you know, that you set up all these conditions and only then are you willing to learn? He said, almost no one has the good karma to be with the really self-realized master. What all the rest of you kids are going to get is going to get people who are a little more advanced than you. And they can help you a lot if you'll let them help you, but they won't help you at all if you stand around and judge them for the process of finishing their own karma. Now, the other thing that I've always found interesting about this, that I found interesting from the very beginning, is the fact that in Swamiji chronicles here things exactly. He talks about, you know, him expressing to Master concern about this, expressing an overzealous concern. I'd rather commit suicide than give in to temptation. And Master says, why speak of suicide? And when Swami reads it, he says, you know, come on, don't be so dramatic, is kind of what Master says. He said, this isn't deep in you, you'll overcome it. And then Swami just states, just categorically, and I have. Now, you have to stop and realize what Swami means when he speaks of overcoming this. He doesn't mean merely that he has control over his impulses. He means he has no inclination to think in terms of male or female anymore. He has no attraction to what is the most fundamental delusion. Swami's not a braggart. He doesn't make statements like that without knowing what he means. Even in the midst of the whole Bertolucci thing, when there was a big cycle within the community, while Swami said everybody worked it out, Swami just went to Hawaii. He said, I just don't have the patience for it. You just figure it out. He said, I've been your friend for all these years, and you just make up your own minds. And then he came back at one point, and he was in seclusion writing a book, and then just at the end he gave a satsang. And he basically said, no one who was a libertine could accomplish what I've accomplished. He just said, it's just not possible. And he just sort of left it like that. Again, just left it to sort of see, you know, where we would go with this.
No one is a libertine.
No one is a libertine. No one who didn't have mastery over their energy could accomplish what I've accomplished. So, I always looked at it the other way around. Swamiji had said it on a different occasions that when he asked Master the question, will I find God in this lifetime? Master said, yes. Everything is balanced. Now, that is, will I be self-realized in this lifetime? That's the question that Swami asked him. And Master said, yes. You know, Swami just puts that. This is one of these things, just puts it out as a sentence. Now, if you believe that Swami is truthful, which certainly that's the premise of my discussion, if you believe that Master is truthful and would be able to answer that question honestly, then you work backwards. Then you realize that you're looking at a person who's having their last incarnation. And then you think, my, my, isn't it interesting how these things play themselves out? This is a little bit of the long discussion we had last week, where at a certain point you have to actually just look at what's happening instead of rebelling all the time about what's happening and throwing up continuously these questions of how can that be, how can that be, how can a direct disciple like Daya be like this, how can Taramata be like that? You have to just stop doing that. And you have to work backwards. And you have to say, wow, look what great souls are capable of doing. You know, look at the kind of karma that a person can face in their last lifetime. Look what it looks like to overcome this. Because Swami says, Master said, you have it, you're going to overcome it. Okay, Swami says, I had it, I've overcome it. So you look at sort of the cycle of you know, being dragged into court and humiliated by these awful women and, you know, forced to describe in detail things that nobody should ever talk about. It's just crazy. But there it is. And then you have to reorient your own life around that fact. You have to see Swamiji at the height of this spiritual bhav. And he's being modest when he's talking to us about how he felt when he was in India, that he was so free. And he had that extraordinary relationship with Anandamayi Ma, and she said such things about him that she's never said about anyone. No one has come before this body and received as in the way that you have received. You know, and I've never been attracted to anyone like I've been attracted to you. Swami just states those things. Those are remarkable statements. And then Swami just talks about this extraordinary freedom, and he's lecturing to thousands of people in India, and he's just drifting through with this marvelous thing, and then he goes back to America and he falls into the clutches of this woman who's in love with him. And so you have to see, wow, the path is really a drama. It's really an up and down cycle, and no one is safe until you're in Nirvikalpa Samadhi. And then he reminds us that Ma had warned him, had encouraged him to try to lift the energy a little higher, but he didn't know how, and he was so enjoying this. You know, she could sort of see the little bit of a karmic cloud in there that was going to pull him down. But even then, Swamiji talks about it, how it was her, the look of desire and the longing in her that he couldn't hurt her. You know, of course he could have hurt her, but he didn't. And again, you have to realize these are all great souls and this is the adventure of their lives. Swami's being very frank. You don't know what else has gone on that we haven't heard about. But you can assume that you have. So when your own life takes a pattern that you don't expect, or your brothers and sisters, you have to see it in context for what it really is. And also recognize nothing is forever. Taramata herself left against Master's wishes and got married and then came back. When they speak in there of the nun who criticized the one for leaving and getting married, it was Taramata. Tara got married. Master said, suggested she not do it, but she did. And she had a child. She came back with a child to SRF. And among the reasons why she lived elsewhere is because she was raising a daughter. Right? Yeah. And then nobody talks about that. It's such a shame that they don't talk about it. Because then you don't get a real picture of the spiritual path. It does irreparable damage to devotees not to know these facts. It's a fine line. It's a dilemma that I actually face within the context of Ananda. Because, well, let's just say a lot of us have been on the path for a long time and some of us have more colorful history than you may be aware of. And I never know whether to speak of all of it or just let it go because it's the past. For the same reasons. It's a delicate point. You don't want to affirm it if it's behind you, but you don't want people to think that they're any different than anybody else for what they go through. I had one more thought with that. Oh, it was Taramata when she came back, someone said to her, you know, how dare you come back after disobeying Master like that? And Tara, in her acerbic way, said, do you want me to just worship my mistakes? It was a perfect answer. You know, I made a mistake, so what? I'm not going to enshrine it for the rest of my life. And that's how Swami, you know, works with this. So I made a mistake. And then he says later, he said, I just realized I couldn't fight all battles at the same time. So I just, and that's also an extremely important point. You know, he writes about that more, I think, in part two, just about how he just couldn't because he was so unprotected as a monk. And none of you, I mean, some of you, I know, have lived as renunciates, as formally, specifically, not merely by circumstance, but by choice. It's no easy matter in this culture. And it's no easy matter, as Swami writes in that paper, because the women don't respect it. They don't understand it. He said in India, at least, they understand. They keep their distance. But he writes here, too, about the woman in the church, you know, teasing them, just not having any concept of what's involved. And it's no small issue. Okay, any other comments or questions? And then Swamiji, of course, while he was there, oh, and then he just has this terrible story of how he needed an assistant and Taramata assigned him this completely uncongenial companion. You know, you can see why Swamiji has been so, he says at the end of this section too, all of his experiences in SRF taught him so much about how to make Ananda. And you can just see that just the sheer helplessness of having a partner assigned to you astrologically when you don't have any affinity for them. And once again, Swami just saying, well, if that's how they want to do it, that's how they want to do it. You know, there's a quality that comes out through all this, which is not a pretense. It is the way Swami is. As much willpower and energy as he has, he also, when it's not appropriate, he just doesn't resist. And many, many times when there are circumstances when a lesser mortal would fight against it. He instead doesn't. He just, if that's how people are going to do it, he's just going to let them do it. He's not going to fight every battle and try to make everything. He doesn't try to control events. When he sees the hand of God, he just sees the hand of God. It's probably a very strong intuitive sense of when to stand up and when not to, but also a very strong recognition of when other people will be receptive to his attempts to change reality. Because since I'm speaking of the Bertolucci one, I wrote this on the website. There was an amazing part of the Bertolucci experience, which was that, you know, we had a terrible lawyer. And Swamiji immediately told us he was the wrong lawyer for us. But somehow the energy was just going toward that man. And the people that Swami was saying that to could not hear it. And Swami knew this man was going to be a disaster for us, and he was such a disaster for us. And Swami just knew it, and he just said, well, there you have it. You know, it was such an extraordinary example of the opposite of what he was being accused of. He was being accused of being such a, you know, a power-grabbing dictator. And in a matter that concerned him so deeply and so personally, he allowed other people to make the wrong decision rather than interfere with their right to make that decision. Remarkable, isn't it? And it's, you know, it's a very subtle quality you don't see because you think of him so much as a person of willpower. But that's a lot of what Ananda is based on, is the kind of example and lessons that Swami has shown of just, if people aren't receptive to what you have to say, then you just stand back and let them play it out. Because if you fight too hard, you do so much violence to your relationships and to other people's free will. And remarkable courage, isn't it? So just exactly the opposite of how can we send the tape out unless you first give it to us and let us review it. All right. All right. Why don't we just take a... It's a little early, but let's take a short break. So the next chapter, called the Delhi Project. You have to also appreciate that for many years, this is not within... I mean, this is within the memory of some of you, but not all of you. For many years, the facts of why Swami was expelled from SRF were never told. The SRF wanted Swami to keep silence about it, and for many years he didn't say anything, and he would argue about, he would just refuse, he wouldn't explain it. And year by year, I must have in my files 10 versions of my separation from SRF. He began to write it slowly at a certain point, and he would write part of the story, and then he would revise it, and then he would write it again, and they became very upset when he started writing about it. Why do you have to say anything at all, they said to him. Why don't you just, you know... And so what it was is when he was silent is that it left him open to, as he put it, rumor and innuendo. Anything could be implied because the facts weren't known. And so the implication was, you know, financial impropriety, personal impropriety, just anything. And he gradually began to write and then distributed a little. It was just very controversial. And finally, when he wrote this book, he just really just decided to say absolutely everything. He would be, you know, he would be less forthcoming about Daya's role. He would protect Daya. He would protect Tara. He would just pass over details. If you read the path, you can hardly tell what happened. It's not even clear when you read the path that he was expelled. At that point, he was still hoping that somehow this would all work itself out and there would be no need ever to explain it. So what he's trying to explain here is just, he's following here finally, and he says it toward the end. He says, I get these anonymous letters. He said, I have no further explanation. I must accept your condemnation, but at least then it's your judgment on the matter. What that's implying, what he's saying by that is, at least now you're not hearing from someone else what you ought to think. I'm going to give you all the facts, and you yourself decide what the right answer to this is. One of the things that I've always really appreciated about Ananda, and we've tried to follow it as carefully as we can, which is why I'm very forthright about many things that maybe the better part of discretion would be not to talk about, is that I just figure you need to make up your own mind. People need to know. They just need to know the facts as they stand, and then you make up your own mind. At least then it's your judgment. I'd rather you had the facts, I mean you in a broader sense, everyone had the facts and decided against us, than not having the facts and deciding against us because somebody else told you to. And so what he's trying to write here is just every single thing he can think of. It's very hard for him to make himself look bad, you know, because he didn't look bad. But it was such a clashing of worlds. And so he goes back there, and Diamat has put her faith in Binai, which again I mentioned last week, if you read Shaped by Saints, which is also a very interesting story by Devi Mukherjee, Swami is very kind to Binai in this book. You know, they are not kind to Binai there. The Indians, Devi was one of them who had to live under Binai. You know, he was one of the insignificant people that Binai was going to expel. And he was not easy to live with. And yet, from 10,000 miles away, he had all the support of the board of directors. And Swamiji was there. And Swamiji's, this monk, Swami doesn't say that much about him, but this monk, Saravananda, well, he just says, again, he says in a sentence what you have to just sort of stand back and realize. Saravananda, of all the monks there, was the most quick to go over Swami's head when Swami was still the monk. And you recall Swami told at the beginning how he gradually lost his position in SRF before he even left, because Dayamata and the other board members sort of moved in on the monks and became their, related them directly, and Swami became insignificant. And Saravananda was one of the worst ones in that respect. So Swamiji found out later that the whole time he was in India, this man was writing reports back, and they were all negative. And so the characterization that SRF was receiving of Swami's behavior was from this monk. And so much of what they later denounced him for doing was this monk's perception of what he'd been doing. And Swami didn't know that for a long time because he's too trusting. That's the phrase Dayamata says, has accused me of being naive and being too trusting, he says later on, which he was. He just didn't expect it. But so Swamiji just took on this project of, there he was in Delhi, in Calcutta, and just nothing was happening. Binay was just dragging him down, and the energy was just terrible. And in a previous chapter, he talks about how one of the monks who went there became nearly suicidal. He was so disillusioned. And every day, Swami gets up, and in this very just down situation with his superior, just complaining about everything, what is he supposed to do day after day? I mean, just literally, what is he supposed to do with himself there? Binay doesn't want him to leave. He has to stay there. He's trying to help Binay. Finally, he's persuaded that he can go somewhere else. And in the back of Swami's mind is the thought that he's been commissioned by Master to make this happen. So he goes back to Delhi, and we've spoken now of Rani Ban, and many of you have seen the picture of 90-year-old Rani Ban. Well, you see one picture of her, you know, when she was in her 40s, and she was vibrant, and she took, Swamiji lived in their home in that little cabin, and they were his partners, and they were working together to really make this thing happen, Indu and Rani, which is why it's just been so meaningful to go back there finally after all this time. But there's an interesting point that Swami mentions in here. He explains it, but it was something he didn't say for many years. For many years, he would tell us the story about deciding to do this, to work to get this Delhi ashram and all this. And he would just tell that story. And then one time he started adding, I didn't actually feel Master's guidance to do it. And he doesn't say in here, but in various versions of this, various iterations, he's put it like this. I didn't actually feel Master's guidance to do this in the way that I was accustomed to feeling his guidance, but I thought I would experiment and see what happened if I went forward without feeling that. And I thought at the time, the first time he said that, I thought, my God, what courage, you know, let's just experiment and find out. I mean, there's no sort of hiding and hedging your bets and I don't know, so I'm not going to do it. It's like, well, this is something I need to understand, so I'm just going to go forward and understand it. I mean, there were other things compelling him, such as he couldn't possibly go back to Calcutta. It was absolutely out of the question. And something, anything, is better than nothing. And so he just sort of set his mind to make this happen. He talks about when we went to India this last, few months. He said, we accomplished more in a few weeks than he accomplished in months and months. As he put it, I sat on my hands in Delhi for months with nothing happening. And that's also part of the strange dynamic of this. There was nothing to write back to headquarters because he had this, what appeared to be just a foolish pipe dream that he was going to build this temple and nothing supported it. So what was there to write back about? Well, nothing is happening today and nothing's happening tomorrow. And it was completely non-existent until it totally came into fruition, which is also Master's play through this. And then he just set his mind to it. I will make this happen. But then he just also tells us he was very strategic. He understood human nature. He understood you get one person to say yes, it's easier for the next person to say yes. You sort of think, and he put it so clearly, you think about what other people are interested in. It's just the mistake that everybody makes, is they only think about what they want. They don't think about how what they want will also benefit someone else and how therefore we can work together. Even when Swamiji sort of teaches us how to bargain for prices when you go into a store, you have to think about what they want. You can't just go in and say, I want this cheaper, because that's not a very friendly way to go at anything. So he had some good fortune. He met Jai Prakash Narayan on the train station and in the train compartment and got him to be a friend. And he went to school where Indira Gandhi went to school. But it's interesting that that little episode of Swami's life being sent to that school in Switzerland was a miserable period for him. It was like the end of his childhood. He had this wonderful childhood in Romania, but then he got very ill. And the doctor thought he had to go, the doctor recommended that he go to Switzerland to a more salubrious climate. So they found this little school and they sent him there. And he was only 9 years old. He didn't even speak French. And he was just far from home and all by himself and absolutely miserable. He was sick a great deal of the time, and until he learned French, the teachers thought he was stupid because he couldn't function very well, and he was just miserable there. And finally, he was so sad, they took him home. They let him go home again. But because he was at that school, he was able to speak to Indira Gandhi, because that was the point that of union. So isn't it just interesting how God's play all works together? And so he was able to speak to her and get her attention. And then he, you know, just adds. And the secretary is always a very influential person, so I made an appointment with the secretary. I mean, he's just giving us such practical instructions for how to make something happen. But behind all of it, you have this picture of this willpower that he had. He moved the entire Indian government to do something that everyone said was impossible. But he said, by my will, I will make this happen. And you have to stand back and think, you know, what kind of will is this to make this happen? And later on, he quotes Taramata saying, you have to have spiritual power to be able to attract money to make things happen. Swamiji, in years later, sort of has said little things like, well, obviously then, there must be here, trying to point out when he's tried to argue with SRF about Tara herself said, how could this have happened? How could Ananda have been built without the grace of God? Look at all that's been attracted, just even on the financial plane. And SRF's answer to that is to pass the rumor around. The first rumor was that it was all built with Swami's father's money. Swami's answer is, he never gave me one dime, not 10 cents for Ananda. Even when he died and Swami got the inheritance, he said to think carefully about what to do with it, because he said his father never gave him a single penny for Ananda, and he knew that his father would be uneasy even in the astral world if he just spent it all on Ananda, but he couldn't possibly spend it on himself. So he compromised and built Crystal Hermitage. That's how Crystal Hermitage got built, with the money from his father, because it was really Swami's home, and so therefore it was sort of for him, but it was for the whole community, and so it satisfied Swami's heart about it too. Let's see now, where was I with this? Oh, the spiritual power, but there was something else that I wanted to say. Well, I forgot it completely. But also, I was just going to say the practical. But there's also just so much fun about this. He thought a picture is easier to see than words, so Swami just made a painting. You know, he is not a painter, but he just made a painting. And when you look at it, it's a charming sort of childlike painting that he just did. It has a wonderful energy to it, and it says what he has to say. Swamiji has this capacity, this determination. If it needs to be done and no one else will do it, I'll do it. That's his operation. It's not that he wants to do things or doesn't want to do them. If they need to be done and no one else will do it, I'll do it. And he thought, a picture is needed, so I'm going to paint a picture. And then just with complete comfort, he just walks in and shows Gandhi, you know, the painting he's drawn, without thinking he has to be a great artist, without thinking of this or that. It's just all his energy is focused toward the energy, what he's trying to accomplish. It's not focused on himself and his role in it. So it just, when you hear all of that, it's just so remarkable that he was able to be successful in such a, you just have this, how thrilling it was for Rani Ban, for Indu Ban, for all the rest of the people there. They were going to build this temple. They were going to make this great thing happen. This was during the period of time that we talked about when we came back from India, that the young, and he's not young now, he's old now, but Kishan was telling us, when Kishan was 16 years old and was the man who drove Swami all around Delhi, and he talked about how every week we would have these satsangs, I think it was the modern school or something like that, in the heart of Delhi, and you know, 1,000 and more people would come, and it was such a blissful period of time. Swami doesn't mention any of that, but that's when all of this was happening. It was during the time he lived in Delhi, and he was building this energy, and they were going to get this ashram, and they were going to make this extraordinary thing happen. And I'm sure, I mean, he doesn't talk about these things, but I'm sure he showed everyone the picture, and it was all so exciting. And then he was successful. And then he goes up to Darjeeling. It's just like you can hardly even think about it. But from their point of view, it's like he'd gone completely mad. Because when Daya got his letter, and Swami says, I wasn't always careful in what I said, and I crowed a little bit, see what I can do. You know, there was that, he takes that to blame. He's trying to be perfectly honest and tell us what could he have done. And he also, he doesn't spell it out in here, but in other contexts he's spoken to the fact that he was too, he spoke too often to die about his own self-doubts. And in other contexts, he mentions that you have to be careful how you define yourself to other people because they may accept your definition. The master said, don't tell your faults to everyone because they may, in a moment of anger, use them against you. That's a more extreme statement. But even sometimes, if in the name of humility or out of your own angst, you constantly define yourself according to your limitations, people may come to define you that way. I had an interesting experience just personally in a very practical way many years later from this and many years ago when Swami was publishing The Path. He went to India into seclusion and the publications business was produced that book. We did the production for it and sent it to the printer while he was out of the country. And I was a key person in that production process because of the job I had. But I, at that time, actually, this was my true perception of myself. I didn't consider myself to be a person who had a very very good artistic sense visually, visual sense. And I often would say that. But in fact, I do have a fairly good sense. I'm not able to create from nothing, but I can fix things or tell when they're not quite right. But I so often said that I didn't have a good sense of it, that when I needed people to listen to me, they wouldn't listen to me. And they wouldn't listen to me because I myself had said that I wasn't qualified to do it. And yet I had both the responsibility and the ability. It was just that I had let my mouth run. And that's a very small concrete example, but that's, Swami was speaking of that, referring to that, that he had that same tendency with Dayamata because he considered her a friend and he opened himself up to her too much. Later in his life, there was there's a story that Swami tells in conversations with Yogananda in which he tells this story and he tells it without names. But when you read it, it's about Daya. He says, Master wanted Daya to be brought from another room and Swami got up to do it. And Master said, not you. You know, you go get her. And then he said to Swami, keep your distance and they will always respect you. Now that was a general advice to him from master to a monk about the nuns. But Swami realized later that he didn't always, he was a little too familiar with Dayamata, and he realized that later on that didn't work because he'd given her too much cause to doubt him. And so he takes some responsibility for that. He just hints at it in here, but that's really what it was about. And he sees again, and these are all very subtle lessons, that some of her, he fed her doubts about him with his own words because he trusted too much in their friendship. See, that's all implied in those few sentences. I was naive. I trusted too much in our friendship. I thought she would understand when I asked too much of her. He just realized I asked too much of her. That's how he sort of forgives it later. I didn't see her clearly. I was just seeing her through my own eyes, and I didn't see her really, her position, her reality, her personality, what it was that she was really about. So here's Swami up in Darjeeling, and the phone call comes in first from Nehru. He says he thinks it was the same day. Can you imagine what that day must have looked like on his horoscope? You know, the same day. Nehru says yes, and Taramata says no. And if you listen to the audio version of this, when Swami sort of imitates Tara, he shouts at the top of his lungs, we don't want the property. And then Swami shouts back, yes, yes, we got it, isn't it wonderful? And Tara says, we don't want it. And Swami instantly says, well, whatever you want. Because he wasn't doing it. He was doing it because he thought it was right for SRF, and if they rejected it, then that's what they did. It's just, it's almost unbelievable when you hear the story, isn't it? What a drama. Yes. Just what an incredible drama. But it all had to happen. There would be no us. If he had succeeded, he never would have come back from India. That's what he and Ronnie Bon and Indu would say to each other, said to each other in the fall, with all of us just sitting there so eagerly. You know, we jokingly thanked Indu and Ronnie for their suffering because it was our gain. And he brought, you know, with our energy, he's been able to do what he's doing in India now. He never could have done it if he hadn't brought all this trained American energy. So then it's just all over. And then he talks about, I won't chronicle that whole year. Whatever I did, I wasn't supposed to do. Whatever I didn't do, I was supposed to do. So Amiji finally, he painted a little picture for the Whispers from Eternity, that beautiful picture of the devotee kneeling with the light coming down. He painted that to be the cover for Whispers from Eternity in India. Again, it was one of those things, there was no other cover, so he thought this, and oh, they didn't want his, Tar wrote back some rude word, something rude about his, you know, his finger paintings or his, you know, just in whatever he did. And meanwhile, this other monk is writing all these letters back about how bad he is, how terrible his attitude is, just feeding them all this, and their mindset was just to accept it. Daya trust, Swami trusted in her friendship, but by this time, Tara has just become, you know, enraged, and she's doing all this astrology, which Swami talks about. Master told her not to do it, but she did all this astrology, just, you know, figuring everything out astrologically. And it's so hypocritical as SRF. Among the things they accused us of in their lawsuit was doing astrology, right? And so we said, but this is just crazy. How can you be doing it? Just, you know, it was just a kitchen sink, every weird thing that you could think of that they thought might prejudice a judge or a jury against us. And then there's Tara doing this. But Tara, as Swami writes, Tara fell. She became, and Daya said she fell because she was doing astrology. She fell because she got involved with people and it just brought the worst out of her. But I love the way Swami talks about it. If she did fall, it couldn't have been very far or for very long. And he respected her enough. You can kind of feel in that, that if she, as soon as she knew she was wrong, she would correct it. She could have been wrong. She could have been mammothly wrong, but as soon as she knew, she would have corrected it because she was really a deep and sincere devotee. And so he says, if she did fall, it was only a slip. Later on, Swami made such a distinction that a slip is not a fall. He said that in his own defense when he was under such attack. He said, a slip is not a fall. Many people mocked him for that, but a slip is not a fall. If you're walking and you slip a little bit, it's not the same as falling. It means that you stumble, that you don't exactly go where you mean to go, but then you right yourself and you go forward. So you have to realize that as mammoth as Tara's actions were and as incomprehensible as they are to us, nonetheless, for her, it was simply that she never did anything by halfway measures. And so if she was going to be inappropriate and wrong, she was going to be inappropriate and wrong on a mammoth scale because she had that kind of power. She was capable of editing the autobiography of a yogi. I mean, that's no ordinary person. She was capable of standing shoulder to shoulder with Master and manifesting these fantastic, I mean, beyond extraordinary things that he brought forward. That is no ordinary soul. So when that energy is misdirected, it's impressive. You know, it was very impressive. But Swami's the first to say it. Anything less would not have worked for him. Because he just would not, if he'd been given anything less than that. I mean, the way he has clung loyally to SRF all these years since show you what tenacity was there. Master had to really use the big guns to get him out. Because it's just so obvious when you really stand back and see how different their realities are. And it's taken them 50 years to get Master's books, even some of Master's books out. As Swami said, nothing he wrote would ever have seen the light of day. He's written 79 books. You know, would any of them have been published? I mean, they were censoring his sermons. What would have happened? This nothing would have happened. But, oh, the pain of it. But then he throws in this interesting, just simple fact. Nothing in this world is created without tapasya. Tapasya is a word that we tend to think of, which means sacrifice, austerity. The actual definition of that word is devotion. Because it's an act of sacrifice that is done out of love for God. So devotion is just as true a word. We used to joke when people would get a name that for fear somebody would get the name like Tapasyananda. You know, just like, oh no, please, not me. Everything, the way Sant Keshavadas said, Swami quotes him in there, Santji said, oh, somebody did a lot of tapasya to bring this into manifestation. And he meant because somebody always has to do a lot of tapasya. In other words, the energy has to be manifested from somewhere. And so some people or group of people have to concentrate an enormous amount of energy to manifest something new. Swami manifested Ananda with many forms of tapasya. He developed extreme arthritis of the hips. In the first 20 years of Ananda, he became a cripple, except he kept walking around because he had so much willpower. After 20 or 25 years of Ananda, he finally had his hips replaced. the doctor said they did not know how he walked. They did not know how he could have even sat in a wheelchair, that he should have been bedridden. He had just nothing left in his hips, and he was walking around on it all the time. But he himself said Ananda was now established, and so he didn't have to carry it in the same way. And so he got his hips replaced. He could have gotten his hips replaced 10 or 15 years earlier. He should have. But it was the tapasya that he was doing. And part of that tapasya was this extreme personal anguish that he had to go through. And as he puts it, all the deep soul searching that was required, that made him, that purified him, burned out whatever the last of that karma was, gave him the sensitivity and the compassion and the clarity of mind and all the things he needed. Because when he started in SRF, he himself advocated all kinds of things that later, after he got to India and after he grew older, he realized were wrong. He didn't know. He had to learn himself by deep suffering and by the insight that's required. And he had to develop the ability which he describes in there. He says it, that he's gifted that way. But he also has developed the ability to put aside how he feels and still be able to manifest properly, because all those years of building Ananda, which are just barely described in here, just required, he had to be completely indifferent to himself in order to do it. And later on he talks about, his own faults, his own shortcomings, his own fear of his own karma, specifically in the issue that we were talking about. He just simply could not be concerned. He had to sacrifice even his own salvation if necessary in order to do this work. And in order to do that, you have to have this strength of character that you don't get from just being carried on the wings of grace. You get that from being buried under mountains of rubble and clawing yourself out with your bare hands. And it's just so, just the thought of that experience, even just that single moment in Delhi and then that year that went on, and then finally going to New York, that incredible scene in New York and that picture of him. For 2 hours I knelt with my hands across my chest in a posture of absolute misery and begged for a second chance. And then Swami puts in that little word, Daya said nothing except once to agree with something that Tara said. He paints Tara as the villain, but out of loyalty to Swami, I have to say Daya in some ways was worse, because she just sat silently and let Tara be the instrument and allowed herself to just sort of appear, not to really be involved. It's just really, it's quite a story. I have to be kind because Swami is kind, but I can also be fiercer because it's a question of loyalty on our side. What a story. Don't you think so? It's just thrilling, though, on the other hand, isn't it? What a drama. And how God uses everyone, and Daya too. Whatever she did will have to be seen in the context of a life of enormous sacrifice. But you also see then what happened to poor Daya. Once she started down this road, she just never could figure out how to extricate herself. And people ask the question of how did it end up like this? Just step by step. And she just kept, her sense of friendship for Swami was that he should have cooperated. Why can't you just help out? Why do you have to talk about this? Why can't you just... Here's one wonderful scene I think he tells later, where she says, why don't you just tell people you resigned? Well, Swami says, I didn't resign. And then she answers, well, you should have. What a ridiculous answer. But it's just the... her thinking, and Swami describes it too, even just he describes it strategically with Tara. She made a mistake, he said, because she thought she could get rid of me all in one blow. And once that blow was offered, if it didn't work, she didn't have a backup plan. And I love this way, the way Swami says, and I fight differently. I fight for what I believe in and not against, and I just apply unrelenting pressure with ever more creative ways trying to find a new way to apply the pressure. It's just so sweet the way he says it. I fight differently. And that's exactly what's happened. He's just applied unrelenting pressure, building Ananda day after day, standing for this truth, just not giving in. And they spent everything they had, and it failed. And a whole new destiny was written at that point. And Daya's just, beside herself. She's just beside herself. She still is. Because it just, I said to Swami too, and he admits it. I said, he says too. He said, I must be hard to work with, he said, because I do have all these ideas, and I don't know myself where they come from. And they don't always make sense, but they do work. And so it was just so impossible for them, with the way their minds were, to even comprehend what he was offering. And then he just didn't go away. He just kept on to the present day. It's just been such an extraordinary development. So I think that's all I have to say. Is there any other comments or questions or thoughts? All right. Next week. So we start into part 2. We read through chapter 22.